But if someone takes a comparative religion course, you realize, well, maybe someone who was born in India and ends up becoming a Hindu, how's that different from someone who was born to a Christian family in America and ends up becoming a Christian? It just becomes, you are what you are because of where you were born and the religious tradition that was passed on to you, but you didn't really actually choose it. And as soon as you're willing to go there, that's kind of a ticket out of religion.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this week's episode, new biblical values,
cultural transition,
and shifting persecution. All coming up next on the Humanist Hour. Welcome to the Humanist Hour. I'm your co-host, Kim Ellington, and I have the honor of introducing the new co-host of the Humanist Hour, Jen Wilson. Hello, Jen.
Hello, Kim. It is a pleasure to be here.
So everybody's going to want to know, who is this Jen Wilson? We need to know three good facts about you so we can pin you down and give you labels. No, I'm just kidding. Oh,
nice try. I have 10 facts. Oh, not really.
Excellent.
I would actually have to think a little bit to come up with three good facts.
Okay, well, how about this? If someone was to ask you, why are you a humanist and how are you a humanist? What does it mean to you? What would you tell them?
What it means to me is that I believe in the inherent value and dignity of all people. I believe absolutely that we're capable of reaching across the aisle and collaborating with people of all walks of life, really. I feel like our culture gets polarized, especially in an election season like this one. We hear a lot of shouting, a lot of digging, a lot of nasty stuff going on out there. And it's very easy for people to get distracted from what really binds all of us together. And I know that in a lot of the free-thinking and atheist and agnostic communities, at least, you know, especially what you see on the internet, there's a lot of anti-religion rhetoric. And that's not going away. Religion itself is not going to go away. We've all got to figure out how to be on this rock together and how to make things better in this culture. And I'm not giving up. I mean, it's very easy to want to pull my head into my shell like a turtle and just hide from all of it, but I don't think we can do that. I feel a responsibility to help create dialogue, to get people talking, and to get people shaking hands and agreeing to disagree now and then so we can keep working together.
I like that. I like it. Why don't you share a little bit with our listeners of your background, your religion or where or not that you've come from and how you came to humanism?
Well, like a lot of people who come into the humanist circle, I started out with some religion earlier in life. I mean, I had kind of a rough start in life. I had a rather difficult upbringing in a home that was troubled. And originally, I was just very much a kid of the woods and the fields. I found my comfort with nature and with the cycles of seasons and renewal that happened. And when I was a little bit older, maybe middle school age, I got connected with a church, and it was really a wonderful experience for me because it felt like I had found a family for the first time, you know, and that was really compelling, that sense of belonging and belonging to something that was larger than myself and feeling valued in those ways. And for a while, it was a really wonderful experience. I really enjoyed asking the difficult questions and challenging what was handed down.
Just like a Christian religion or something else?
It was, yeah. It was a Protestant denomination. Okay. I don't really want to name it here. I don't want to pick on anybody.
Oh. Absolutely not. Okay.
Yeah, I had a great time bandying around these difficult concepts and these tough questions that young people have, and hopefully a lot of older people too. But there came a point, of course, when it was expected that you would turn the corner. And that when you become a young adult, you would leave those questions aside and become, you know, what they felt was more responsible and stop asking those questions. And at the time, I was, you know, I was a leader in some ways. I was helping out with youth camps and stuff. And, you know, I had just come to college. I was learning a lot about comparative religion. And it had dawned on me that, you know, maybe I never really was a Christian in this sense. And I was also faced with some of the social stuff that was going on in these circles, like, there was a popular belief in this denomination among the young people that, you know, this is really horrible, that being gay or homosexual or, you know, whichever term they applied back then was somehow worse than committing suicide in the eyes of God.
Oy.
And kids would pass this stuff around with this fear behind them. And Yeah, nobody was correcting that. There was nobody in a position of power that I could see was coming to these kids and saying, come on, that's not true. And so they were just left to believe this stuff. And I realized, you know, I felt like there was only so much I could do to combat it at that point. And I realized, you know, the church is not for me. If this is how it's going to be and this is what they're kind of riding on to keep the tribe together, I can't be a part of it. And so I drifted away and gradually realized that I am not only a non-believer, but also a humanist, in that I really do believe in the good in people and in what binds them together.
So it's interesting that you brought up, you know, going through those questions and all this cultural stuff, because today we're going to be speaking with Mark Smith, who's a professor of political science and an adjunct professor of comparative religion and communication at the University of Washington. And he has written a book called Secular Faith: How Culture Has Trumped Religion in American Politics. And I think definitely the searches that we go through as young people, you know, they start to become, as we find answers or don't find answers, become American culture in our case. And we have today with us Dr. Mark Smith. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for being here. So you have a new book out, Secular Faith: How Culture Has Trumped Religion in American Politics. Now that is a mouthful. Tell us, what is this book about?
The book is about changing values and norms and even worldviews to some extent in American society, how those have come about, and how religious groups, and especially Christian groups, since those are the biggest and most powerful ones in America, have responded and adapted to the rise of what I'm calling secular values. So those are things like tolerance and freedom and equality and basic principles of democratic citizenship. And as those have, we take those for granted now, but if you go back 300 years, even 200 years to some extent, 100 years, I mean, they're always evolving. There are, you know, elements of denials of freedom today that I'm sure 10 years from now we will see as a huge historical blunder, in much the same way that, say, we would look back on the way that gays and lesbians were treated in the very recent past in the same way. So it's about how the society evolves in its beliefs and values, and how the Christian majority adapts and changes in response to those to that evolution.
We see a lot of rhetoric nowadays, especially in an election cycle, and the word war gets bandied about in this rhetorical way. The war on Christmas came and went. There are wars on different values, and this is really all over the political spectrum. From your perspective, how do you define cultural war, and why is it so powerful?
Right. Well, that's a great question, because I do have a different take on this than you will kind of see in the popular discourse. Mm-hmm. So especially now in a campaign season, it very much looks like the country is fundamentally divided. And, you know, some people who shall remain nameless are calling for a ban on all Muslims to enter the country. Meanwhile, right, the rest of his party isn't quite going that far. But, you know, they're saying, well, let's let in the Christian refugees from Syria, but not the Muslim refugees from Syria. We have still very stark divisions on abortion and some other issues. So it looks like the country is fundamentally divided. And one of the claims that I try to make in the book is that picture is distorted because we're only seeing the divisions. If you think about how the news media operates, they're in the business of reporting on conflicts. They want to put news out there that you'll find interesting. And typically that's about conflicts. It's about things we disagree about. They don't typically cover things we agree on, because what's the point of saying, hey, and today in Congress, nobody proposed to make blasphemy a law. Now, I would say it's actually interesting that no one is proposing to make blasphemy a law, because within the American past, especially the American colonial past, blasphemy was outlawed. And so the fact that we're not trying to outlaw it now, that's relevant. So there are all these things we agree upon that we don't talk about precisely because we agree upon them. And one of the things that I try to show in the book is, how do these agreements come about? So we went from a situation where at one time in the, you know, large majority of the country, it was believed that it should be a crime to proclaim that there is no God. Now that idea would seem absurd, and no one is proposing to do so. So what happens during that transition period, and how do the Christian groups, and especially the leaders of those groups who tend to set policy, who tend to write doctrines and give sermons and so on, how do they adjust to those new values that arise on the scene?
Mm-hmm. I was actually kind of thinking that you started out saying he could we were going to have him remain nameless, and yet his name is in the title of your book in a little way.
That's true. He did sneak in there. That was totally unintentional, but you're right. That's funny how it worked out that way.
It is.
Well, you spoke of a transitional period in terms of values that are evolving. For purposes of analysis, how do you define a transitional period? And you've covered some key social issues in your book. I'd love to hear your thoughts on whether we're toward the beginning or end of any of those. Do you have an example that you want to throw out to us?
Sure. I mean, I mentioned earlier the attitudes and beliefs about homosexuality would be a great example of this. Mm-hmm. So we are very much in a transitional period right now. If you go back just a few decades, we were pretty close to a consensus on one end of the spectrum. So it used to be, you could be arrested for soliciting gay sex. There were the larger heterosexual majority viewed homosexuality as immoral, wrong, whatever you want to call it. If you were gay or lesbian, you would generally try to be discreet about it because you would worry about backlash in the workplace or from friends and family. So I'm sure you could find a small number of heterosexuals back in, say, the 1950s who thought that the common cultural approach to that matter was ridiculous and wanted full acceptance. But they were just a tiny sliver of the population. It was pretty close to a consensus saying, this is horrible behavior, we ought to crack down on it. Hey, isn't it great that we have these laws to make this illegal? And then starting in the late 1950s, you get a gay and lesbian movement arising, forming organizations like the Daughters of Bilitis and the Mattachine Society, and they start pushing back against this. Initially, in a very kind of soft way, that voice becomes strengthened in the 1960s and becomes more assertive and aggressive. By the 1970s, we have kind of a full-blown gay and lesbian rights movement. But at that time, the larger public was still very much on the other side of the issue. Those movements were seen as kind of, you know, fringe topics. And at that point, we start getting pretty good data on public attitudes toward homosexuality. And as of the early 1970s, about 90% of Americans said homosexual behavior was immoral. So a strong majority, so strong that I would call it a consensus being an overwhelming majority, thought homosexuality was immoral. Those attitudes really don't start changing until about 1990. So mm-hmm. Even through the 1970s, 1980s, the vast majority of Americans would say homosexual behavior was immoral, and they would also largely oppose efforts to accommodate civil liberties for gays and lesbians.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. I'm your co-host, Kim Ellington, with my co-host, Jen Wilson, and we are speaking with Dr. Mark Smith.
Again, that starts to change in the 1990s, and it's been an upward trajectory since then. We're now about 25 years into that change, and it's been changing for most of that time at a rate of about something like, you know, 1 or 2 points per year. So kind of barely detectable on a year-by-year basis, but when you accumulate that over 25 years, it ends up becoming really big changes. And just as of a few years ago, you got the first time where more people were saying there was nothing morally wrong with homosexuality than that there was something morally wrong. But notice that was just a few years ago. And so even today, you get something like 40-45% of the American population who would say it is morally wrong to have same-sex sexual relations. So we're in that transition right now. And then a lot of what I explore in the book is, how does this play out both in the popular domain, in the news media and public debates and so on, but also within the Christian majority religious communities? Because on the first, and a lot of this comes about through new biblical interpretations. So it's pretty well known that the Bible, when you just read it, it looks like it condemns homosexuality in several different places. And that indeed was the way Christians viewed it for centuries, really. And that doesn't start to change until the same time where there's these new values emerging in society. And then some Christians go back and they revisit their own scriptures and they say, well, do they really indicate this thing that we've thought for a long time that they believed? And you start getting new interpretations coming along saying, no, actually the Bible doesn't condemn all same-sex relationships. It only condemns particular forms of homosexuality, such as pederasty, so an ancient practice of kind of a mentorship, male mentorship, older men and younger boys or young men that could become sexually exploitative, or it's condemning male prostitution in pagan temples. So the new interpretations say the Bible actually doesn't oppose homosexuality per se. It only opposes certain forms of homosexuality.
Mm-hmm. Unless you're in the state of North Carolina where they, you know, we still passed an amendment, not this part of we, not the I part of we, but our state passed an amendment only 3 years ago stating that marriage is between one man and one woman. They need new Bibles, I think, Mark.
You bring up an interesting point, Kim. Mark, you have said before that a lot depends, in terms of this cultural shift, a lot depends on what type of Christianity or what individual belief system within it is prevalent in a given region.
Yeah, there's no doubt that there's a regional cultures in America. It's well known the South is the most conservative part of the country, possibly with the exception of the Mountain West. But the South, with a large evangelical population in the Mountain West, stronger Mormon contingent. And the way I like to think about this is there are different parts of the country, and at any given point in time, they are different. But then when the changes come about, they all change roughly in the same direction and at the same time. So if you look, say, right now, if you just ask Americans, you know, do you think same-sex marriage should be legal? Of course, it's settled, at least temporarily, constitutionally by the Supreme Court, but we still the question still gets asked. And now it's up to like something like 55% to 58% who would say it should be legal. So that's a national average. If you go in the Northeast, it's probably something like, you know, 65 to 70. On the West Coast, again, 65 to 70. In the South, maybe 40 to 45. So lower in the South than the rest of the country. But yet, that 40 to 45% in the South is a huge amount of upward change from where it was just 20 years ago. So if you go 20 years ago, it might have been support was 20% in the South. Meanwhile, back then, it might have been 40% in the Northeast. But you can see that both regions are changing. It's just that the Northeast started from a higher base, but both regions are changing in the same direction and at the same time. And so if this process continues, you could reach a point where the support that exists right now in the South will continue to go up, and it'll reach where the Northeast is. And then theoretically, it could emerge where you get a strong consensus saying both same-sex marriage should be legal and there's nothing morally wrong with homosexuality. I actually don't think we're ever going to get there. I think an interesting parallel is with divorce. So if you think about what's happened on divorce in the last few decades, it's basically not a political topic. And this is one of those areas where I say that's actually an interesting phenomenon. So I want to study both the things that are being talked about politically, but also the things that aren't being talked about, because the things that aren't being talked about actually tell us something about how politics works. So that you will search long and hard to find any candidate for office who says we ought to ban divorce, mm-hmm. or even we ought to restrict divorce, make it harder to obtain. And so we should try to figure out why are no candidates proposing that? Why is there a consensus now that we're not going to take a hard line on divorce? Yes, some people object to it, and obviously it affects people at an individual level, but it's not a political controversy. That's the key distinction.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because immediately what comes to mind for me is the Catholic Church, who is still against homosexuality, still against divorce, still against abortion. That's kind of a big uphill battle there, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a big uphill battle in that the Catholic Church has some distinctive features that are different from how Protestant churches work. So in the Catholic Church, the kind of ideology of the church is we're a 2,000-year-old tradition. We don't change. Peter was the first pope. You know, Pope Francis is the 267th or whatever it is. And it's this long continuing tradition. So the it's kind of built into Catholic ideology that we don't change. But actually, they really do change. And one of the things I try to explore in secular faith is the ways in which the Catholic Church changes. The main way it changes is not by updating its doctrine. It's occasionally they do that. So in the Second Vatican Council, they actually did update some doctrines, and at other points they've updated doctrines. But usually they don't change by updating doctrines. They change by not talking about certain things anymore. So a classic example of this would be contraception. So everybody knows the Catholic Church opposes contraception. Well, it used to be the Catholic Church not only opposed contraception, they actually lobbied state legislatures to either outlaw contraception entirely or at least restrict its availability. And in the 1950s and 1960s, the states that had the highest Catholic populations and the most priests who were kind of active in this debate were also the states that passed the most restrictive laws, which interestingly were states like Connecticut, New York, Pennsylvania, states that we tend to think as being more liberal today. But they were the states that had the strongest regulations on contraception. Well, as we move through the 1960s, the availability of the pill and other forms of contraception start spreading. Eventually, pretty much everybody is using contraception. Current surveys of the Centers for Disease Control show that something like 99% of all people in America, including Catholics, Catholic women, are using contraception. So in terms of behavior, Catholics are no different than anybody else. But the church still maintains, if part of its official doctrine, contraception is wrong. So how has the Catholic Church accommodated this huge change in practice and in attitudes? Well, the way it's accommodated this is by no longer lobbying to restrict the availability of contraception. So it keeps the doctrine, but it doesn't make it a political issue in the way that it used to make contraception a political issue. And that's kind of the path that homosexuality is heading. So if you look at some of Pope Francis's statements on homosexuality, essentially what he's trying to do is to de-emphasize the attention to the issue. He actually hasn't changed any doctrines. He said some nice things when asked about homosexuality. He said, "Who am I to judge?" And that was widely interpreted as him saying, "Hey, no big deal. You know, you're gay, I'm not, whatever, let's to each his own." But he hasn't gone in and tried to revise the Catholic doctrines that say homosexuality is a sin. And I think that's unlikely to happen. But what is happening is he's giving less attention to that issue. So he's kind of making it not as much a political fight anymore, so that he could keep the doctrine but de-emphasize the issue politically.
I have a question about the name of your book, starting out with the two words together, secular faith. And I think there's some readers who would scratch their heads and say, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. I'd love to hear some of your thoughts behind that name.
Sure. I'm glad you asked that. If some readers scratch their heads and they're not sure what that's up to, I hope that's a good thing, and that a lot of book titles are kind of boring. And you know, if you can grab someone's interest, then they're probably more likely to investigate further. So I was looking for two terms that would be a contradiction or an oxymoron, you know, Iron Butterfly, Led Zeppelin, that kind of idea. I may be showing my age here with the band references, but in any case,
mine because I got it. So
that's right. Thank you for laughing. I appreciate that. So with secular faith, it can work two ways. So it could mean faith that has become secularized. So much like we were talking before about how some secular values have, in a sense, infiltrated religion and that are shaping religious responses to political issues. So faith has become secularized. That's one of the messages of the book. But then you could say it's not secular modifying faith. It's more like faith in secularism, in that these secular ideas are spreading throughout society and shaping it and manifesting themselves in all kinds of ways. So it has kind of that double meaning, and really either way that people interpret it is fine by me, because they're both consistent with the larger themes of the book.
I like that. Having faith, I have faith that secularism will continue to spread. That needs to be my morning mantra, I think.
Yeah,
it reminds me why I do what I do every day.
It is spreading. And some people in our community are sometimes, you know, pessimistic. They will look out at the world that exists and say it's not as good as it should be. And I would actually agree with that. But it's still a lot better than it used to be. And in a lot of these areas, the secular values actually are developing and spreading and becoming more influential over time. So I'm kind of in the Steven Pinker, Rebecca Goldstein, Michael Shermer sort of wing of secularism, and saying if you look over the long term, there's no question the world is much better than it used to be in terms of protection of rights, in terms of the amount of violence, in terms of respect for individual autonomy, and all kinds of ways. If you look over a scale of centuries, there's just not even any debate. I mean, it used to be we had slavery. It used to be we, burned alleged witches. It used to be nobody had any rights. So by comparison to that, the world today is a lot better. Now, that doesn't mean the world is as good as it should be. That doesn't mean we shouldn't continue to fight in areas where we need to make improvements. But the trend is very positive. And I would say the reason that trend has emerged is because we've had these secular values that have developed, have evolved, have shaped more public debates and left a mark in terms of public policy and public attitudes towards all these important issues.
So that kind of brings me to the second half of the title of your book, that culture has trumped religion in American politics. And yet when we watch the new candidates for both parties right now, not one of them is culturally aware outside of, well, that's not true. I can't say that. But there's still a whole lot of, they feel like they have to not only admit to, but profess in belief in the supernatural, generally in the form of a god. And then most of the Republican candidates are severely religious in a painful way for many people like myself. So, and these are the people that are getting elected. Like they're all elected officials and they're trying for a higher office. So like my first reaction to the title of your book was, it seems like the opposite to me.
Yeah, I can see how you would say that. There's no doubt that America is still a very religious country. So this show actually has a nice resonance with the one that you had a couple weeks ago with, I'm forgetting his name, Ryan...
Cragen, yes.
Cragen. So he's written some about the rise of these so-called nuns, so people who proclaim no religious affiliation. But even when you take that into account, still some 73% of Americans will proclaim a religious affiliation, and depending on how you measure it, in which survey, something like 95% of Americans will profess a belief in a god of some kind. And that's the population in which you have to run for office in. So if you were to stand up as a candidate and say, I'm an atheist, that's probably not a very good campaign message. So we shouldn't expect very many candidates to say that anytime soon. And as you say, Kim, there's no doubt that the Republican candidates this time have been kind of more religious in a certain sense than their recent predecessors. Now, keep in mind, this is while they're competing in a Republican primary, of which over half of the Republican primary voters are Christian evangelicals. So if kind of that's who you're immediately competing for votes for, you want to signal to those people, hey, I'm one of you, you can trust me, all of those kinds of things. But if you look deeper beneath the surface, yes, they are religious, but they're religious in a very different way than their predecessors were. So one of the themes of my book is Christian conservatives actually aren't nearly as conservative as they used to be. Used to be they supported slavery. Used to be they pushed for prohibition. Used to be they wanted to outlaw blasphemy. Used to be they wanted to restrict women's rights and so on. And in all of those areas, they've changed greatly. So yes, there still are these culture war divisions, especially on abortion, to some extent still on homosexuality, to some extent on a few other issues, teaching evolution versus creationism in schools and so on. So those divisions still exist. But the conservative Christians are not pushing for things that their predecessors pushed for. So that's the respect in which I say culture is trumped a religion, and that these secular values have shaped the approaches of even conservative Christians to political issues. And they often don't know that they've shaped them. So whenever conservative Christians would stand up and say, we ought to support women's rights, well, that's not what their predecessors said. But today, you don't see any conservative Christians out there wanting to, keep women out of the professions or restrict women's political rights, restrict voting or political participation or things of that kind. Now, yes, there are some fringe movements like the Quiverful movement that would perhaps take a somewhat different perspective on those issues. But that's a tiny fringe. On all of the basic questions, those are now settled. And so I say culture has trumped religion because it's shaped how religious leaders respond to political issues.
I would say, I wonder if it's morphing more than anything else, though, because they are still trying to and successfully putting their laws in my body to tell me what I can and can't do with it. And they are all professing to be very tough on crime, which has led to the mass incarceration and, essentially continuing racism, but putting a prettier face on it without using the actual word racism, the criminalization of people of color. So I'm curious, because that's our culture right now. And I'm not sure, it feels like it's religion that's actually trumping those of us who are fighting for the opposite, but maybe that's because I'm on that side and that's my perspective.
Yeah, I mean, you're certainly right that in terms of laws restricting abortion, those have spread like wildfire in the last few years. Requirements on abortion clinics, trying to put them out of business, 20 week waiting periods, all kinds of restrictions on abortion across many states. So that debate is certainly front and center right now. And actually, it's not even getting as much attention as it should because these restrictions are happening at the state level. And a lot of people that are in states where those haven't been happening might not even be aware of them. So I think that
attention. Exactly. Yeah, that's a good point.
I think that issue deserves more attention than it's been getting.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. I'm your co-host, Kim Ellington, with my co-host, Jen Wilson, and we are speaking with Dr. Mark Smith.
That one is one where we haven't seen a cultural evolution. So I do study abortion in my book, partly because it makes for an interesting contrast with the other ones that I investigate. So in the other ones that I investigate, you see a long-term trend where the values evolve and they push in one direction. And over time, that pressure leads to new biblical interpretations. It leads to religious leaders accommodating those positions. It leads to some of the things we've talked about, like with the Catholic Church, adjusting its policies on contraception, where it keeps the doctrine but no longer pushes to make it a political issue. That hasn't happened on abortion. If you look at public opinion on abortion, since the Roe v. Wade decision of 1973, basically, in the net, nobody's changing their mind on that. If you ask this in different ways, like should abortion be always legal, sometimes legal? Should abortion be legal under certain circumstances, like for rape or incest? Should it be legal if the on economic grounds that the mother can't afford to provide for the child and so on? If you ask these in different ways, you see no net change over 40 years, which is really pretty remarkable. I claim that's the basic thing that's keeping this as a viable political issue for the right. In other words, they still have a constituency that backs them, and the leaders can take aggressive positions on this and essentially not pay a political price. You can contrast that to the homosexuality issue, where back in 2004, the same-sex marriage was considered a wedge issue for the right, where George W. Bush was pushing for a constitutional amendment to ban it. This was supposed to be a means to like win votes for Republicans. That was in 2004. Mm-hmm. By 2008, it was really no longer a viable wedge issue for either side. By 2012, it started to become a wedge issue for the left. And certainly by 2016, especially if you're trying to attract new voters, young people especially, being against same-sex marriage, that's now a losing position.
Unless you're in North Carolina.
Unless you're in North Carolina.
Right.
At least nationally, it's a losing position, and that's it's only going to become even more so as time goes on, because these trends are kind of already built in, where the older people are more conservative on that, younger people are more liberal. So even if nobody changes their mind, over time, as more of the older people die off, more of the younger people become a greater share of the voting population, the trends are already built in. They're going to continue. So that issue becomes more and more of a losing issue to be against same-sex marriage, as opposed to being against abortion and wanting to restrict abortion rights. I would claim right now that is not, it's not necessarily a winning issue, but it's not a losing issue either. It's very much an evenly divided issue. And so that's why I think it's going to continue to be a real struggle as we go forward. In terms of like the criminal justice system, I think the main things driving that aren't really religion. It's,
money.
It's race, money. Now we have a prison industrial complex where a lot of states kind of use building prisons in rural areas as a jobs program. We have this momentum, so we have a war on drugs. So there are all kinds of pieces on that I think aren't really religiously driven, but they are important issues for the humanist community to address. And I'm glad you brought them up, because that would, in terms of like the problems of our times, the criminal justice system deserves a prominent place on that list.
Yeah, and I think definitely I have to say for my own part that I don't want to conflate, just because I see the conservatives being irrational about criminalization, that doesn't mean that just because they're religious and conservative, you know, that it equates to conservatism. So,
right, I can see there's different forms of conservatism. You know, economic conservatives, racial conservatism, social conservatism, etc.
Oh gosh, I keep drifting back to what you said earlier about the media and its role in what's going on in our culture right now. It really fosters this sense of immediacy with people. You know, whether or not that's true, it's really what comes out. There's this feeling created in the rhetoric and in the coverage that, oh, it's all on the brink. My rights are going to be taken away, or my religion is not going to be respected. And I also think that has been a little disadvantageous on, you know, the non-believer side. I think that religion has, in a lot of ways, become this monolith, a sort of blank boogeyman. And I'm not sure that, you know, there's enough understanding, even among non-believers, that a religion can evolve. And so I'd love to hear your thoughts on how do we create space for these kinds of conversations in a culture that is so polarized and kept on edge.
I don't think I have a great answer to that question, but I do have a perspective on the larger themes you're bringing up. Mm-hmm. So certainly if you look at what's happened in the religious right in the last couple of years, this new theme has emerged of we are being persecuted, you know, our rights are being taken away.
Right.
Which, if you look at it, you know, in any kind of objective sense, it's kind of laughable. But what I think that rhetoric is doing is it's serving as a movement building. It's a message designed for insiders.
Mm-hmm.
There is certainly sense among a lot of people in the religious right that they're losing the culture war issues, that fewer people are identifying as religious. The atheist community is growing, the non-religious people with no religious affiliation, that's growing. So they have a sense that the country is changing. They don't like those changes. So just a few years ago, they would have been more active in saying, oh yeah, and we need to block same-sex marriage. Well, now we have same-sex marriage, so it's a little harder to push that politically. So instead they've shifted to say, well, we're being persecuted because what if some Christian florist has to provide flowers for a same-sex marriage? That's persecution. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think about the history of persecution in the world, in this country, or what currently goes around, you know, real persecution is you express a belief and you get locked up, you know, you get tortured, abused, and so on. Even if there was some Christian florist out there who had to provide flowers for a same-sex marriage, the notion that that's persecution—I mean, it's patently ridiculous. But it in the Christian community, you know, it's sort of founded on the idea of martyrdom, right? Crucifixion.
Sure.
And that message is really powerful in holding people to the faith. So when you can go to Christians and say, we're being persecuted now. Our florists have to provide flowers for same-sex weddings. That resonates with them, and it does serve a movement building purpose, even though calling that persecution by comparison to, you know, what ISIS is doing, what used to happen in terms of burning witches and people who, for expressing particular religious beliefs, being run out of town on a rail, that's real persecution. And that's certainly not what's going on here.
So in other words, there's a level of privilege implied even in the rhetoric that we're using and the way it's being used.
Mm-hmm. Persecution gets defined down. And, you know, persecution now becomes somebody said something I don't like, so I'm being persecuted for that.
Right.
I'm interested, since you are at a college and you were with the beginnings of the generation that affect the culture that I'm going to live in as an old person. What do you see? What do you see with the younger adults that you're working with now, as far as how they see their culture affecting politics?
Well, if you compare them to like the, you know, 60s generation, they're more career focused now, which I think is a very sensible response. Most of the students I see, they're pretty serious. They want to get their work done. They're in college. They want to get a degree, figure out what they're going to go on and do with their lives. And in an uncertain job environment, that's a very sensible response. They're also more diverse racially and ethnically, and more tolerant than previous generations of young people have been. And that certainly shows up in their political attitudes. So on issues like homosexuality and approaches to the criminal justice system, they are different in those respects than the older generations. One area, interestingly, where they're not so different is in abortion. So the young people have a perception as being more open, secular, tolerant, et cetera. And I think in general they are. But if you look at the data on abortion attitudes, they're not much different among young people than the rest of the population. And that's one of the reasons why, like I said before, I think taking the strong conservative stance on abortion is a viable political issue in a way that taking a strong opposition to same-sex marriage is slowly becoming not viable anymore. And that the religious conservatives, in a sense, have been able to hold young people, or at least a significant share of the young people, in their midst, even those who don't come at it from a explicitly religious standpoint. So even a fair number of people who would claim no religious affiliation actually are very uncomfortable with abortion and would accept a lot of restrictions on it. And so those who are wanting to oppose the new restrictions have got a lot of work to do in terms of persuading the young people that this is a real threat to women's rights and reproductive health and so on.
Interesting. You know, one of the questions I thought when I found out that you were a professor of comparative religion is a lot of atheists who have been converts from various religions have mentioned that it's their comparative religion courses that changed their life and set them on the path towards atheism. So how does it feel to be molding a generation of free thinkers?
It's a good place to be. I think knowledge is a wonderful thing, and it can change people, certainly. If you grow up in a community where you're familiar with your religion and no others, the others, they seem really far out. Like, who could possibly believe that? In the area where I grew up, pretty much everyone was Christian. There were a few, there were some different types of Christians. So the vast majority were Protestants. This was in central Ohio, about 20 miles outside of Columbus. So it was a very conservative area. The vast majority of people were Protestants. There were a few Catholics, a couple of Jews, and that's it. I mean, you would never meet a Muslim, a Hindu. You'd never meet an atheist. So people from other religious traditions, you just didn't have much experience with them. You didn't encounter them. But if someone takes a comparative religion course and you actually start to figure out, okay, well, people who are Hindus, what are some of the key beliefs? How is this embedded in the culture of India? And once you start doing that, you realize, well, maybe someone who is born in India and ends up becoming a Hindu, how's that different from someone who was born to a Christian family in America and ends up becoming a Christian? It just becomes you are what you are because of where you were born and the religious tradition was passed on to you, but you didn't really actually choose it. And as soon as you're willing to go there, that's kind of a ticket out of religion. Because as soon as you recognize that your own religion has been passed on to you, that kind of takes away some of its status in a certain respect, and then you entertain other possibilities. And so I think you're right that exposure to comparative religion, to other people's beliefs, does have a tendency to make people start questioning their own beliefs. And so that's one pathway for people out of religion and into secularism and atheism and humanism.
Excellent. Jen, do you have any other questions for Mark?
You know, I really appreciate everything that went into this book. As the book jacket copy suggests, it's a very hopeful message, isn't it?
It is. I think there's a lot of things we agree upon that aren't talked about, and we should just be aware of them. Some of the things that I mentioned before in terms of, you know, we don't have slavery anymore. We don't have prohibition anymore. We've made major advances in women's rights and so on. And those things are broadly shared now. We have a consensus on them. And those ought to be upheld, and we ought to recognize the things we agree upon in addition to the things that we don't agree upon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and taking a longer view of these issues really does help me exhale a little bit when I step back and think about them sociologically and anthropologically. You know, when we're caught in the crossfire of the election rhetoric and so on, I think that things are trending in good ways in a lot of cases.
Good. I'm glad
you
came in with that. Yeah, you're welcome. I'm glad you came in with that message because I want to encourage the long view. You know, in the short view, you look at what we can name him now, Donald Trump is saying, or Ted Cruz, or anybody else on the right, and for a lot of the rest of the country, they look at that and the statements would seem outrageous. But keep in mind the things that they're talking about, but also the things that they are not talking about. So mm-hmm. as much as Trump isn't really pushing the religious issues as much, Ted Cruz is. Trump is pushing more of the ethnic and racial issues. But in any case, neither of them are proposing prohibition. Mm-hmm. I'd say that's a good thing. You know, prohibition is within our, you know, recent past, you know, within the last 100 years anyway, of American history, and the fact that we've sort of settled that dispute should be acknowledged. Now, we do have a war on drugs, and that's still up for debate on what we do about drugs. So we don't have prohibition of alcohol, but we do have prohibition of marijuana and other drugs, and that's there's starting to be pressure on that. So the hopeful message of the book is a lot of these trends are in the positive direction. I would say the vast majority of them. And we need to step back from the current day-to-day fights to really celebrate the areas where we have had major advances in basic human rights, in prosperity, in treatment of people as individuals, and so on. And that's all something to be celebrated.
Excellent. Dr. Mark Smith, thank you so much for being with us today. Tell our listeners where they can find your book.
It is available in some bookstores. I've seen it in Barnes & Noble. And it's, of course, available online through the usual sites, Barnes & Noble or Amazon, and at the University of Chicago Press's website as well.
Excellent. Is there anything else you want to make sure our listeners know before we let you go today?
No, this has been a great conversation. I appreciate the questions, and it's taken us in a lot of interesting directions.
Definitely. We love your perspective. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah. Thank you, Kim and Jen. Appreciate being here.
It was a pleasure.
All right. Jen, what did you think?
I thought that was terrific. I mean, it's such a hopeful message. I mean, there's so much out there in the media, on TV, in the banter we see on the web. There's just so much that feels kind of hopeless. But, you know, like we said in the wrap-up, you know, if you take a long view of some of these issues, it really is getting better. And I take heart in that.
Yeah. And that was a good thing. I'm glad that you brought us around to that, because it is really easy when we're fighting all the time, when, you know, with the secular coalition, we're in our local governments and our state governments fighting against, I guess, the ridiculousness that's out there. It is good to remember that the trend is going up. If you have any feedback for us, you can contact us at humanist@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. And until next time, I'm Kim Ellington.
And I'm Jen Wilson.
We'll see you next time. Thank you.
Hey, everybody. This is Bo Bennett. I just wanted to take a moment to let you know about the Humanist Conference coming up. 75 years of humanism. Chicago 2016. Save the date. This will be at the Hyatt Regency McCormick Place Hotel in Chicago, the Windy City, May 26th through 29th, 2016. Already, there are plenty of people booked, great speakers, speakers that you may have heard of before, maybe you haven't heard of before, but they're going to be talking about some wonderful things, great issues. You'll be both entertained and informed. So do save that date. And if you want to book early, go ahead and do it. Go to conference.americanhumanist.org, and you could find all the information about the conference as well as the registration form. If you want to save some money, register before January 31st, and you get an early bird registration rate. You can't pass that up. All right, everybody, you take care, and hope to see you there. Bye-bye.